Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast, where good taste and slogan sound effect. Hello, my name is Whitney Seibold. I am a film critic, and with me, as always, is my intelligent and scintillating co-host.
Yeah, my name is William Bibbiani. Everybody calls me Bibbs, and hey, remember when Whitney used to care?
Wait, what? What are you talking about?
About the intro. Now it's just like, meta.
We do have a slogan that we use occasionally.
Yeah.
We've
been slack.
Yeah.
We've been slack.
I think we're less enamored of it now than we were at the beginning.
Yeah, it's fine. We have all these shows.
You're here to hear us talk about movies. You're not here to hear our pithy slogan writing.
I like
skills.
A formula. But anyway, this week on Critically Acclaimed, reviewing actually a bunch of new releases this week. Reviewing the new releases Venom, Let There Be Carnage, Titan. Not Titan, I know that's how it looks, but it's French. It's Titan.
Titan, yeah.
The Addams Family 2, The Many Saints of Newark, I'm Your Man, No One Gets Out Alive, and the Welcome to the Blumhouse Amazon exclusive, Black as Night. That's a lot of films.
That's seven of those.
That is.
Ooh. We got seven movies
seven.
This week.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I'm good at math. I went to film criticism because I'm bad at math, so we're fine. Let's just jump right in. The big movie of the week, the one that actually
that is the highest earning film of the week,
and actually did really well at the box office, like better than I think some of us were expecting it to. Did better than the previous film did pre-pandemic. And that is the sequel to Venom called Venom, Let There Be Carnage. And by the way, thank you for a colorful title. Thank you for not just like Spider-Man 2 Venom or Spider-Man. 2. He's not home anymore. Like, no, like, let's actually like there's some drama in that title. I kind of love that.
Spider-Man, he's out doing laundry. Speaking of Spider-Man's laundry, Venom... Venom started his life as Spider-Man's laundry during, I think it was the Secret Wars crossover event.
Yeah,
A lot of superheroes went into a costume-making machine that they found on an alien planet, and it made them all new costumes. It was a good way to rebrand the characters a little bit.
Yeah, and Spider-Man's costume had been torn on this battle world, and he overheard everyone talking about, oh, this is this great machine, and it fixes all our costumes. And Spider-Man,
you mean a sewing machine that he knows how to use, clearly, because he made that? Yeah, anyway.
Well, anyway, he goes to this, like, alien rec room and thinks he's using the right costume-making machine, and he's not. He's actually attaches himself to an alien symbiote that is alive and conscious and actually, for the most part, kind of parasitic.
Yeah.
And, that's a weird origin for anything, isn't it?
The costume is a living thing, and it can turn into, like, this blue tar-like glop.
It's supposed to be black, but they gave it, like, a shine so that it could actually, pop, but it's black.
It's like tar, and, in the comics, that tar thing came off of him at one point, wrapped around another person, and essentially became Spider-Man's evil twin.
The idea is the symbiote, like, amplified Spider-Man's powers, but it also was kind of like, you know, an after-school special kind of drug PSA, and he started becoming, like, angry and more violent and not very Spider-Man, and he had to reject it, and the symbiote, you know, completely, you know, lovelorn, ended up attaching itself to someone who also hated Spider-Man, this guy named Eddie Brock. Can we just talk, just real fast? That's a wild idea. That we're going to give Spider-Man a costume made out of living tar that has a personality and becomes a drug that then ends up leaving him and joining and becoming like his stalker. That's a weird thing they did.
The costume wants Spider-Man back and hates him and loves him, but also wants to kill him. And
I can't get over how just bizarre that is.
In the comics,
you know,
character evolved, it became like much more monstrous. Like Venom at first was like evil-looking Spider-Man, much larger with like claws, and then a big scary-looking grin.
Yeah, big giant shark teeth.
And the teeth got bigger and bigger, and the jaw became larger, and it got a big lolling tongue and was spitting slime and ate human brains. It's ugly.
It's a
really like gross looking monster.
Yeah.
In 2018, they made a movie about Venom sans Spider-Man, and I think the concept plays better if you don't have the Spider-Man concept attached to it.
I'm actually 100% in agreement on this. I was a kid when Venom like first came out as a character, and was reading
the
Spider-Man.
Mid-80s, the character started.
The costume was introduced in the mid-80s, Venom was introduced by like the late 80s, and like I remember Venom being Spider-Man's new great arch-nemesis, and he was everywhere. He got his own miniseries in the 90s. I was there for Venom Fever. And speaking of someone who grew up reading Spider-Man comics and loves Spider-Man, I'm not, that doesn't make me better than anything. It's just like, I have a lot of affection for Spider-Man as a character. Venom as a Spider-Man character is kind of silly. Venom as just an alien that attaches itself to somebody and forms like this weird, unhealthy relationship with them.
But it looks like Spider-Man's costume, so it's like an evil Spider-Man.
So just take away the Spider-Man aspect of that, and you've got a perfectly good idea in and of itself, and you don't need to spend like 2/3 of a movie introducing the whole Spider-Man thing, which is one of the problems with Spider-Man 3 is that it took forever to like set up the idea of Venom. And then by the end of the movie, you had to kind of rush him in the third act.
Yeah,
so, like, they were kind of doomed from the start because they weren't going to make, like, a 2-part movie.
So we have Eddie Brock in Spider-Man 3, who's played by Topher Grace. Eddie Brock, the same character, but now completely reimagined for the 2018 film, is played by Tom Hardy. The alien goo attached himself. It turns out the alien goo is not compatible with every human being.
Yeah.
And found just the right person. And by the end of that film, they were sort of like roommates who like joshed each other and occasionally would go out and like slay bad guys.
And they were also kind of in love with like the same woman played by Michelle Williams. In this new one, they're lovers.
Yeah,
so they are clearly lovers in this new one.
This is the second film in which Michelle Williams is made completely miserable by her boyfriend and his male lover. Because that's also the premise of Brokeback Mountain.
it's a good point. I don't know if that's the hook of both of those movies, but it does happen.
This one, we meet them and they're roommates, but they bicker like an old married couple.
Yeah.
That is Eddie and the voice in his head, Venom, also played by Tom Hardy.
With a lot of CG, they whatever.
Distort his voice. Yeah, but
I love Tom Hardy's performance as Venom. He sounds like a really pissed off 1990s Coca-Cola announcer.
Yeah.
Everything is awesome! There's no subtlety to his inflection. Everything is huge, and I love it.
We should be out there snacking on bad guys. And Eddie has decided to start feeding this monster that lives inside his body chicken brains, but the monster doesn't like that. So the monster keeps on ordering Eddie to go out into the world and actually like murder people in the street because he wants to eat his favorite thing, which is brains.
He wants to compromise. He says he'll do it with bad guys, but Eddie's still uncomfortable even with that.
Meanwhile, in the local prison, a serial killer, very Mickey Knox from Natural Born Killers, played by Woody Harrelson, a guy named Cletus Cassidy. Woody Harrelson is 60 years old, and he was a teenager in 1996.
According to this movie.
Yeah, he's playing a character like a good 20 years younger than he is.
I love that they expect us to, like, Woody Harrelson was starring in movies as an adult in the 90s, and he'd been around for a while before that.
He was on Cheers,
we know how old he is. That's like saying that Jason Statham is Vanessa Kirby's age in Hobbs and Shaw.
they're 20 years apart.
What are you doing to us? Holy shit, just say he's old. Who gives a shit?
But he plays a serial killer, although in a PG-13 sort of way, where they talk about how he's done horrible things, but we never really get the details. He's murdered a bunch of people.
They don't make him cuddly though. He's clearly like a monster. He talks about drinking human blood and stuff like that. He's clearly a serial killer. I don't think that they hide the gore a little bit, but it's pretty harsh.
There's a not very well explored plot element about Eddie is a journalist and he doesn't really do a lot of journalism, but that gives him access to the Cletus Cassidy character. During one of their conversations, Cletus bites Eddie and unwittingly sucks out like a little piece of the Venom monster.
Yeah.
And wouldn't you know it, that thing grows inside of Eddie and turns into another thing, and together they become a creature called Carnage, who is larger, Has a lot more tentacles and knives and things, and of course he's a serial killer. He has no compunction about murdering everybody.
Yeah, so Carnage has, whereas Venom has to make like compromises in order to live with his human symbiote. Carnage does not. The one thing that Cletus Kasady demands of Carnage is that they break his old girlfriend out of superpower prison. His old girlfriend is played by Naomi Harris. She is a villain from the comics named Shriek, and she has supersonic screaming powers, which,
as it turns out,
ironically, is actually one of the symbiote's two weaknesses. It's fire and, like, supersonic sounds. Mm. So what we have here at the core of this movie are two polyqueer relationships. We have Eddie and Venom, and they're both totally cool with Michelle Williams. And over the course of the movie, they get a little bit more cool with her boyfriend. Well,
they were on the outs with Michelle Williams because she's engaged to a new man.
But even then, there's this total, like, and Venom is fine with her. And there's a bit later on where she flirts with Venom, and Venom's totally into it. Also, like, there's this bit where, like, Venom is trying to make Eddie feel better after she says she's engaged at the beginning of the movie. And at first it seems like he's being, like, the over, like, you know, oh, I've been kind of a shitty roommate, let me cook you breakfast. Mm. But then he realizes he's being hyper-domestic, and he's kind of like, and now I can, now he's all mine.
Yeah.
It's like, it's really adorable, actually.
The scene where the creature's, like, tentacles are reaching out of Tom Hardy's back, making him breakfast, and making a mess in the kitchen is one of my favorite things.
It's adorable! He's trying so hard!
It's like, I'm gonna make you some waffles and want some ketchup, splat! It's like something out of Eddie's
like, not happy about breaking stuff, but Venom's trying really hard, and he loves Venom for it, and it's really sweet. But
the centerpiece of the movie is when they break up.
Yeah,
you've made my life miserable, and it's like, you were nothing before you met me, you know, get off of me, I can't have you in my life anymore, and the blob jumps off him and starts jumping from person to person, making them sick and presumably killing them along the way.
Yeah, because they're not soulmates.
Compatible with anybody, and he goes to a coming out party.
Yeah!
It's like a Halloween fair, but he gets up on stage, grabs a microphone, like Venom, this big monster.
He's covered in rainbow glow sticks, talking about literally the line of dialogue is, coming out of the Eddie closet, a woman comes on to him and he says, not my type.
Yeah.
And then he has this incredible monologue about why it's important for people of all types to live together openly and accept each other on what he describes as this giant ball of fuck. And everyone's like, yeah! And my favorite part is this one guy, he's like, early on in the speech, the guy goes, yeah! Just random dude in the back, and Venom says, thank you, one person! Yeah. It's just so funny, though. But the other thing,
now we have Venom as a queer icon.
Yeah. Tom Hardy's part of that as well. Michelle Williams is part of that as well. And then we have Cletus and Carnage and Shriek. And what ultimately is at stake here with, you know, they're killing a bunch of people and it's bad and Venom has to try to stop them, yada, yada, yada. But it's not about which not about which symbiote is stronger. It actually ends up being about whose poly relationship is more secure. Because ultimately this sort of like rivalry between Carnage and Shriek is probably going to end up being their downfall way more than can Venom punch them harder.
Yeah, like,
and I love that. It's a character driven superhero story about romance. That's so cool.
It's got a lot of wacky stuff in it.
So funny.
The pacing is pretty wild. It is a mere 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be any longer. It really doesn't.
Not really. I mean, it could have. It's a little brisk. Maybe it could have used a little bit more room to breathe, but like 5 minutes or something at most. Like
it doesn't need much
more than this.
A little bit more to establish Eddie as a journalist.
Yeah.
But apart from that, yeah, I think it just gets to the point. It feels like superhero films of a previous era.
Yeah.
And I think we didn't realize how good some of those older ones were, maybe.
Have you watched Blade recently, the original Blade?
Not for a couple of years, but I've seen it. I owned it. I've watched it a couple times.
I rewatched it not that long ago. It holds up great. Yeah, it's really efficient. It's really sharp. It's
Special effects are cheap, but whatever.
Yeah, it's more plot-focused than character-focused, which is something that I think the 21st century superhero movies do more of.
Mm.
And I think you might miss that a little bit, but as just a pure action movie, it's solid. And Venom has that super efficient plot, but because it's actually about something very sweet. Mm. Even the serial killers are like, all they want to do is get married. Like, it's actually very, it's a very heartwarming kind of movie. And there's even bits at the end where Cletus Cassidy is trying to talk to Eddie Brock about, like, here's why I connected with you in the first place as a serial killer and a journalist. I'm reaching out. I'm looking for family. Mm. And he even talks about, like, yeah, okay, I killed my grandmother and my mother and, like, my dad. But did you ever ask why? And it's actually, like, more sympathetic to the villains. And these are evil villains who do horrible things without forgiving them for their sins. But it's more sympathetic to them than a lot of other superhero movies. Mm. Hell, it's more sympathetic than Dear Evan Hansen. And, like, I'm actually, like, just totally grooving on this movie. It's fast-paced. It's romantic. Oh, it's funny. It's very funny. Like, I'm really enjoying this film.
I was actually going to say the humor is the one thing where I think it lags a little bit. And Andy Serkis is good at sort of...
Andy Serkis directed this, by
Andy Serkis, the director, yeah. Was able to put together something efficient, something that had, you know, a good, interesting character work, a good, interesting kind of concept about this romance between this journalist and this monster blob from outer space. And I can see a lot of humor kind of bubbling under the surface, but I think he's so eager to keep things going that he doesn't let the jokes breathe from time to time. And I feel like there's a little bit of a lighter tone he could have taken, but I feel that maybe if he had, people would start comparing it to, like, the Avengers movies, which all have sort of, like, those, that quippiness to him.
Yeah.
It could have benefited, I think, with a little bit more lighthearted humor moments. Not overall tone, but
I think of this as like one of those, like, it's almost like Dharma and Greg kind of things, where, like, the world was pretty normal. Dharma and Greg was a sitcom from the 90s. I don't know if anyone remembers it.
The archetypal Manic Pixie Dream Curls.
Yeah, it's about a really straight-laced dude who ends up in a whirlwind romance with a very fiery, impulsive, hippie type young woman, and they end up very impulsively getting married, like, after, like, dating for, like, 2 days. And then now they're stuck together, and she's annoyed by how straight-laced he is, and he's annoyed by how carefree she is, and of course they're perfect for each other, yada yada yada. This is that. Okay, and I feel like that's where the humor of this lies. Everything was kind of normal and 90s efficient or whatever in terms of, like, movie making, until this Venom guy showed up. And Venom is this chaos agent. Venom is this, like, manic pixie dream goo that just sort of popped in and has made everyone's life, like, a weird chaos whirlwind of nonsense and violence and brain eating. And everyone, he's like Alf. Like, everyone just kind of loves having him around, but he does eat all the cats. Like, it is a problem. But I love how much Michelle Williams, by the way, I hope she got a much bigger paycheck in this movie, because notoriously she didn't get a big one for the last one. Mm. Like, she is one of the great actors working today. That is totally true. She's one of the greats, and she is completely underserved in these movies. But every single time she gets, like, a funny scene, she's so damn good. Mm. And she gets to just be really funny in this movie. I wish there had been more of her. Yeah, it would have been great to have seen more of her.
Her character gets to wear the glop in one scene, just like in the last movie. There's a wonderful scene where she confronts Eddie with Venom inside of her, and they're both sort of using the same confession to confess different things to one another in the same scene.
It's a good bit of writing,
cute,
actually.
Sweetly written scene.
I like how she's, like, she's engaged to be married to this other guy, but she also knows that she's totally got the hots for this alien goo and this other guy. And she talks about it with her fiance, and he's, like, super awkward about it.
Did you ever see the movie Splendor, the Gregor Rakim film?
Actually, I did.
Where Kathleen Robertson starts dating two different men at the same time. One of them is Jonathan Sheack. And the other is an actor whose name I can't remember right now. But
I'll look it up, I guess, while you're describing it.
She finds that her relationships with both of these men are kind of advancing at about the same pace. And so she's in the awkward position of having to choose one. She can pursue one or she can pursue the other. And because this is a Gregor Rakim film, she doesn't have to make that choice and ends up dating them both. And they live in a polycule.
An actor named Matt Keeslar.
Matt Keeslar.
Both end up being a big deal, but he was also in Scream 3, Rose Red, Waiting for Guffman. He was in some good stuff.
All right. But this movie reminded me of Splendor.
Yeah.
And by the end of Splendor, Kathleen Robertson has to choose between dating sort of a new straight-laced guy or both of her old boyfriends. And because it's typical sitcom stuff. It's like, oh, well, I'm not living with a slob. I'm living with two guys, and that's a lot to deal with.
It is.
In like a roommate basis. Just there's so many. We have to worry about like what kind of groceries we're going to get for three, and that's something I'd never considered before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm seeing with the relationship between Eddie Venom and Michelle Williams.
Yeah, it's the roommate shit that gets in their way. It's having to share a living space when they're kind of uncomfortable, like, expanding their boundaries. But once their boundaries are clear and once they realize that what's really important is that they really care for each other, that's the important thing in the movie. And the movie, like, I mean, it basically concludes with a declaration of love. Like, it's really, it's so damn sweet.
This weird movie about black goo that is also a shark is a romance film at the end of the day.
And I'm telling you, I can't get over how much I just had fun. It's funny, it's sweet. It's the plot is, again, not what we're here for, but it's at least cleaner than last time.
Yeah.
Where it was full of a bunch of like, oh, I don't give a shit about this evil corporation. That has nothing to do with it. At least here it's all character-centered.
Do something with another symbiote, etc., etc.
Ended up being an odd film, but a very, very fun one, and I'm glad you liked it, too. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, speaking of odd films, let's talk about Titan.
Titan is the latest film from Julien Ducournau, who did a film called Raw a few years ago.
Mm-hmm, which is a cannibal horror movie, and it's really good.
Yeah, Raw is about a medical student who goes to veterinary school, and during initiation is like covered in blood and forced to eat like a rabbit liver.
And she'd been a vegetarian, her whole life, so she'd never had any meat, and now all of a sudden she becomes obsessed with it.
She tries it and she becomes obsessed with eating meat and starts following these really rather dark impulses that are leading her to consume human flesh.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome. There's a lot of similarities in Titan. Mm-hmm. The main character we see in a flashback at the beginning of the movie how she resenting her father from the backseat of the car while they're driving, is kicking the back of his seat. It turns to admonish her and immediately gets in a wreck.
She hits her head hard.
She hits her head hard. We see that she has a spiral scar on the side of her head.
Mm-hmm.
And we see there's a titanium plate covering her brain. And immediately following the procedure, she walks back out to the car that injured her and gives it a hug. Mm-hmm. That's the intro to this movie.
She forgives the car, but not her dad. Years go by. She is now a successful model. She's reasonably famous. People ask her for autographs, and she's working at a car show. And how far do we go with the plot on this? How far do we go? Like, what do we explain? Because there's definitely stuff that like you don't want to ruin.
Well, there's two movies, but it's
weird and full of bizarre incident.
Halves to this movie. The first is really kind of like wild and violent, and the second is a little bit more introspective. In the first half, she is beset by lovers and stalkers of various genders, and she after. Having an evening alone with the car. She climbs into the car and has a sex experience. She has sex with the car.
Yeah.
And it impregnates her.
Yeah.
And immediately following that, she begins like leaking oil out of her body. It's, her body's being transformed by this sex act with the car.
I'm going to take it from here. And then I'm going to be as vague as I can while still giving you the gist. Violent incidents ensue in the first half of the movie. And in the second half of the movie, she winds up living with an older man under another identity. And their relationship is on some level parental and on some level not. And it's really fucking weird. And if it wasn't for the fact that she was still pregnant with the car, you'd almost wonder if it was a different film.
Yeah. It's significant to note that when she goes undercover under this other identity, she goes undercover as this man's missing son. She finds that she looks a little bit like this missing man,
This kid has been missing for like 10 years, so they don't know what this kid would grow up to look like.
She sees like a computer composite of what he might look like.
It's a little bit like her, yeah.
she, in a really painful scene, she mutilates herself in a bathroom to look a little bit more like him, like smashing her face against things. And yeah, she's picked up by this guy, and it's almost like that the Armin Tamzarian thing from The Simpsons, where it's like, we know this is not real, but
this is emotionally what we're gonna pretend. Yeah. I was thinking about Armin Tamzarian the whole time.
And in that second half, also worth noting is this man who takes her in, a guy named Vincent. He's juicing. He's addicted to steroids. Mm. And he is a firefighter, and he lives with all these other dudes. And it's all very masculine. And so what we're doing here is using sexuality, female wrath, a blurring of gender lines to really deconstruct traditional masculine gender roles. Meanwhile, a woman is pregnant with
possibly a car. Yeah.
And is leaking oil out of her body.
Her relationship with men in the beginning of the movie is defined by apathy, violence, or being attracted to a car instead of men. Decoding Titan is something that I think people are going to be doing for a while.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to dig out of this, and I really appreciate the way that Julia Ducournau has just blended it all together in this wonderful art house freakout movie.
She is not concerned with explaining anything, really. But what she is, what makes the movie work, because there's definitely, this movie rides a thin line. Like, there's a line this movie could have easily crossed into camp. Into pure horror.
I think a lot of people were wanting. It's like, it's the movie where she fucks a car. It's like, that's not an element of it, but that's not what this movie is about.
It's not wacky. It's not like so bad it's good. It's not some sort of shout out to schlock. All of the films, and we haven't even talked about all of them. Like, there are major plot points we haven't even discussed, and we want to let you have those. But all of these elements are rendered with absolute emotional purity. Mm. The emotional core of these characters and their journey is real, even if the things that happen around them are bizarre enough that we don't even know how literally we're supposed to take them.
Yeah.
And that is what gives this movie an enormous amount of power. And I'm reminded of some of the maybe the less popular works of David Lynch, something like Lost Highway, where it's kind of this surreal mystery, and it makes sense, but only if you have the clues and the movie isn't concerned with giving them to you. So what you have here is a narrative that is bizarre, has its own sense of logic, isn't concerned with telling you that logic, but is absolutely enthralling enough that you want to know more and you're thinking about it. And I've been thinking about Titan ever since I've watched it. And I'm looking forward to reading more and more people like presenting their own thoughts on this, because I think it's going to be really illuminating. For me, I mean, definitely it's about gender roles. That's definitely a major part of it. But for me, I'm looking at this as a very modern approach to where and what is love. You know, people who want love don't know where to find it, don't know how to respond to it. They've been hurt.
Yeah.
And they'll take it wherever they can get, as long as it feels real to them, even if they know it's a lie. There's something that's really just haunted by it, and I find that very arresting.
I would love to talk to Julia Ducournau about David Cronenberg's movie Crash, or just David Cronenberg in general, because they both, at least to date, seem to be making movies about similar subjects. That is, people who are unable to stop themselves from following their impulses, even if those impulses don't really exist in any kind of real world.
Yeah.
Raw is about that appetite and about how one is driven to follow that. And Raw plays more like a horror movie because it's cannibalism and there's a lot of blood and gore. Yeah. But
it's easier to wrap your head around Raw as a metaphor for things like addiction or eating disorders, or even an illness that is passed from generation to generation. It's
hereditary.
It could even be hereditary illness, right. You know, that kind of thing.
And yeah,
these are the anxieties that can totally poke up in Raw, and it's easy to connect that to reality, even though the movie is very surreal.
Yeah, and I feel like Titan is also about somebody who has iconoclastic appetites.
Yeah.
And this character's appetites doesn't run toward the human. There's nothing in humanity that has ever appealed to this person.
Yeah. And every attempt they've ever made to try has gone badly enough that it hurts them very, very badly, and they feel the need to lash out.
Credit where credit's due. The actress is named Agatha Roussel, and or Agatha, perhaps, Roussel. And
they're amazing.
She is
an amazing
so good in presenting somebody who is cold to what the world is offering her, but still has a drive towards something that is clearly in her heart, even though she doesn't really know what that is yet.
She doesn't seem to understand what kind of connection. She understands attraction, but connection has been always kept at an arm's length, and so that is alien to her.
The means through which she's connecting to the rest of the world is through this mechanical device, through a car at first, and then through something something human and male, secondly.
Yeah.
And how it's essentially how she's essentially going to eventually reconnect with humanity, but it has to be on her terms. This isn't about finding a spot in the world. This is about creating her own world. And Julia de Carnau has given us a complete alien world that is a fascinating place for us to explore where she can find that home.
It is so hard to find a movie. I mean, we can connect it. Like, I compared a little bit to Lost Highway. You compared a little bit to Crash. But generally speaking, this is a movie that is difficult to find a direct link to, like, a cinematic past. And I think that's something that's incredibly exciting to see. Again, whether this alienates you or enthralls you or anywhere in between, and there was two polar opposites. Like, you're gonna see in this movie, this very fucked up movie, something that isn't happening right now in other films.
Yeah,
and that in and of itself is so exciting that even if the rest of the movie wasn't so, like, emotionally harrowing and warm in a weird way, even if that wasn't there, this would be fascinating and probably worth recommending just purely on the fact that it's new. But it's new, and yet it feels deeply connected to humanity. Maybe just it's using language, like narrative language, cinematic language, that I don't think has been codified yet, sometimes.
It's a little alien. It's going to be really opaque to a lot of people.
It's definitely not.
It's designed to be super off-putting. Yeah, so
if your tastes skew mainstream, you might not have any idea what to do with this movie, and I'm pretty sure Julia de Carnau is fine with that.
It's one of those things that, though, is going to warrant a lot of discussion, a lot of dissection, and even after a lot of analysis, you may still not like it. But I appreciate that it has a clear idea about whatever its idea is. I know that's the
Rotten Tomatoes quote.
Yeah, right? I guess so.
It's a clear idea about
whatever it is about, because it's not straightforward.
No.
It's not like something like Us, where it just has a lot of ideas that are just sort of splaying everywhere.
Yeah, or like a mythology that doesn't quite make sense.
Yeah,
you think about it too hard. This isn't a mythology movie. This is a movie. Again, it's definitely got some surrealism in it. I mean, I hate to just throw that word around because I know a lot of filmmakers don't even like it, but it's hard to be, like, semi-surreal. It kind of defeats the purpose. But again, I think if you're a fan of, like, the more obtuse David Lynch or the more obtuse David Cronenberg, you definitely need to see this.
Yeah,
it's a different thing, but that's definitely, like, a good litmus test for whether or not this will engage you. And if that sounds exciting and you're not familiar with that kind of cinema, please go check it out. You're going to see something really weird. It's going to be very challenging, and things might be very, very exciting for you. I hope you enjoy trying to crack it open and see, like, where this leads. But yeah, this is definitely a movie that's not going to be for every audience member. It is for us, apparently. I'm really, really glad I saw it. So this is a very interesting film.
I really dug it, and I'm waiting just to see how well it sort of stews in my brain.
All right, you had a busier week than I did, so you saw several films I did not see. While we were talking about bizarre family dynamics, why don't you tell me about the Adamses family? too.
Anything to bridge these films.
Look, I gotta come up with
something. We're gonna go from Titan to the Addams Family too.
This is the sequel to the animated movie.
Yeah, there was a 2019 animated film of the Addams Family, which I did not like. Because the animated Addams Family was about how we were introduced to the Addams Family based on the famous New Yorker comics written and drawn by Charles Addams.
I will say this, I think the casting for Gomez and Morticia was pretty spot on. He had Oscar Isaac and Charlize Theron. That's good. Even in live action, that's good casting.
Really good casting. Chloe Moretz plays Wednesday.
I forget who played Pugsley. Someone. One of the kids from Stranger Things, probably.
Yeah. His name is Javen Walton.
No idea.
Yeah, I like the casting, and I loved the character design. I think they made them look, updated them, but a lot like the old Charles Addams cartoon. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they looked, like, kind of monstrous, and, Morticia was positively skeletal, and Gomez looks like a guy who has taken a few swords to his torso. my favorite design was actually on Pugsley, because he looks like a vicious little shit who has firecrackers.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And that was his character. He liked it's explosives, and he was really kind of a ne'er-do-well.
Yeah.
And what I've always liked about the Addams Family, from the comics all the way through the Barry Sonnenfeld films, I didn't see some of the straight-to-video ones or the Broadway musical.
There was a straight-to-video sequel to the Barry Sonnenfeld films starring Tim Curry and Daryl Hannah, which isn't as good as the films, but is pretty good and is worth seeing if you ever get a chance. I didn't see, there was a couple attempts to reboot it on television. With that cast, I think some of it.
Okay.
But you've seen the John Astin, Carolyn Jones TV series, right?
Oh, yeah.
I've seen that one's great as well.
Seen the 60s TV series. Not all of it, but I watched a lot as a kid.
Holds up pretty good.
Way better than the Munsters, as far as I'm concerned. The only way the Munsters excels is the theme song. The theme song to the Munsters is unassailable.
And the Addams Family still has a good theme song, though. So it's still a net positive.
Written by Vic Mizzi wrote that theme song. But what I always liked about the Addams Family was that they relished in their own strange interests. Our values were simply a mirror to theirs. We value life and togetherness. They value murder and killing people. Yeah. But through that, they found a kind of dark, macabre affection for one another. Yeah. And they actually cared very deeply about one another.
Their domesticity is actually very positive. Like, I remember just the pilot for the original Addams Family. I think it was the pilot for the Addams Family TV series was Gomez and Morticia found out that they were supposed to be sending Wednesday and Pugsley to school. Mm. Like, someone stopped by. They're like, oh, well, take them. Go for it. And so they go to school, and then Wednesday comes home crying because they read some story about a white knight killing a dragon. And she's like, that poor dragon.
Yeah, exactly.
And they go to talk to the teacher about, you're telling stories about killing defenseless dragons? And that just illustrates, I mean, it's an obvious joke, but it illustrates the dichotomy right there. They're the anti-family in a lot of ways, but they also really love each other.
And the Barry Sonnenfeld films, both of them, are really quite good. Yeah. About and that's very much about how they value death, but they love each other for it. The opening scene of the first Addams Family movie is Christmas carolers, and we pan up the building, and the Addams Family is pouring hot lead on them.
They're gonna die.
They're gonna die. They kill. And
but they're so. Here's the other thing I think is really cool about the 60s show in particular, but I think the Sonnenfeld films pushed it to like to 10. There's so many people who think that in order for romantic relationships to be effective, they need to be like pre-married. Marriage is the end of the story. Or their marriage needs to be full of bickering. Those movies and the show prove that you can be super into your spouse, totally in love and lust with them forever, and your stories can still be interesting. That's a great lesson to learn.
John Astin was always kissing all over Morticia, and there's a fetishistic element that Barry Sonnenfeld brought to the movies, which he's clearly taken from, like, Tim Burton. It was all in that
stuff. Oh, yeah, that was very popular.
Same camp at the time.
He made it his own.
They made an animated film, which is, it's rated PG. It's for kids. And so they have to dial back on the death a little bit. Mm-hmm. But the theme of that movie was they move into their mansion. It's sort of an origin story. And while they're in their mansion, sort of like a prefab town forms in the base of the mountain where they live.
And their mansion has been like surrounded by fog for so long they don't notice, and no one in town notices they're there.
The fog blows away, they see the town for the first time, and they're fascinated in sort of like a biological way. It's like, what are these creatures? Let's go check it out. And they move down, and there's a wonderful scene where they're just sort of encountering the real world for the first time and they don't understand it. Yeah. I love those scenes, but ultimately it starts to be about how, wait a minute, these creatures that we live nearby are actually very sensitive creatures and we need to be open to that. In fact, let's try to be like them. Let's be good neighbors. Mm-hmm. And ultimately at the end of the film, they became
accepted.
Yeah. Good neighbor, accepted parts of the neighborhood. That's not what the Addams Family is. The Addams Family should not be accepted. They should murder people.
Well, I will say that
they poured hot lead on Christmas carolers.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I think the big problem with that movie is that the actual plot of the film, once the plot kicks in, is stupid and terrible, and it's about like their house being renovated for a reality TV show. It has nothing to do with anything. It has nothing to do with anything. It has nothing to do with them. It's something that happens to them. It's not something that they do. And I think that's the real tragedy of it. The Addams Family can totally drive their own story. But you're right. Making them less outsidery is, you know, I can see
what they are.
I can see why it's kind of like My Little Pony. Like, I see where you, why you thought that would be an unassailable message, but I don't think it fits the material. Hmm. And it's the same thing with Addams Family, but in a different way. It's like having them just be accepted ruins the fact that they are permanently outsiders, which is the appeal, because we all feel that way sometimes.
Well, and you know? Sometimes we like that. Sometimes we want to be on the outside. Sometimes it's exciting to be on the outside.
Sometimes the mainstream is bad.
The mainstream sucks. So let's go on the outside with these people who live in a haunted mansion and have a ghost living in their
mansion. I would have killed to live in the Addams Family house. Like, when I was a kid, I fantasized about living in the Addams Family house.
I'd like to live in the house, but if, like, Pugsley and Wednesday are around, I'm going to die.
Oh, we're all going to die. I don't understand. Like, are they cartoons? Because she kills Pugsley a few times in those movies.
And he's okay afterwards.
So clearly it's fine. They're like, cartoons. They're cartoons.
Yeah, she's strapping him into an electric chair. We're going to play a game. It's called Is There a God?
And then she
electrocutes him.
And Morticia lets it happen. It's like, okay, come on, stop playing. He's like, oh, come on. All right, make it quick. And then they kill Pugsley. Yeah. Like, they're cartoons. Clearly you would live. You would live and you would be fine. And pain don't hurt, apparently.
The Addams Family 2 gets that part right again.
That's nice.
They're freaks again, and I like that. The plot is a little childish and a little dumb, and it's still suffused with way too many like pop culture references and hip stuff and music
cues.
What's the
worst music cue? What's the worst needle drop?
I Will Survive. They do I Will Survive.
God, that's tacky.
Wednesday and Lurch find themselves in a biker bar in one scene, and in order to placate the bikers, just like in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, they do a pop song, and it turns out Lurch can sing this like falsetto version of I Will Survive.
Oh my God.
That's pretty insufferable, but at least they're monsters.
We were just watching The Replacements. We were just watching it. They just did the same thing.
The opening scene is Wednesday at the school science fair, and she's figured out a way to extract intelligence DNA from a squid and put it into Uncle Fester.
So
very slowly over the course of the entire film, Uncle Fester is mutating into an octopus.
That's funny.
That's pretty. Like at one point,
that's funny. Okay, I'm with that.
He's got a tentacle. Oh, where'd that one come from? Where are we driving? We're driving by water. He dives in.
That's kind of funny.
Like splats ink.
And
out
it's easier to do in animation, so you can really go nuts. That's cool.
The plot of the but she is really upset when it turns out because this is the way this contest is set up. Everybody gets a trophy, and she's really upset about that. It's like, no, I extracted DNA. I deserve a trophy.
I deserve the trophy.
But she does get the attention of a Steve Jobs-like tech magnate who says, why don't you come and intern at my place? Gomez has seen that his daughter is sort of drifting away from them in some abstract way. She's getting a little older. She's an adolescent.
They had a cute bit of that in the first movie where she was like hanging out with like normal kids and she wore a pink barrette.
Yeah, and like, what is that?
Morticia was like, you know pink is a gateway color.
That's right. She comes in with a red balloon. I thought, what is that thing? Usually there's a killer clown attached to these. But yeah, they're still concerned that Wednesday is drifting away. So Gomez comes up with the idea, we'll go on a road trip. We're going to go across.
Yeah, Addams Family Road Trip.
Addams Family Road Trip. It's fine.
Low hanging fruit, but whatever. It could work.
It's totally functional for a kid's movie, especially with the Addams Family.
And, they're, and it keeps them in, like, especially after you establish that they're accepted in their town, this keeps them weird. Puts them in situations where they're the outsider.
There's a really great line of dialogue from Morticia where she says, well, like, why don't we go across the country and we'll explore this nation's dark secrets? And Morticia says, well, you know, as dark secrets go, this country isn't bad. They don't delve in very deeply with that.
No, like, there's, you know, that could get real dark, like, real fast, just by having a casual conversation.
So they go to places like Death Valley, you know, not so dark.
They're not
going to
engage with some of the really horrible, horrible past that we've.
But there's some really wonderful exchanges. Gomez pulls Morticia, or Wednesday pulls Morticia aside at one point and says, "I know why Father's behaving this way. He's dying. Don't tell Pugsley. He'd rather be surprised."
It's a good line. Yeah, that's a good answer.
It's like, oh, but darling, I was trying to tell, if you're going to ask my permission to take a lover, you may. So, like,
that's good dialogue.
That's good Adams Family-like dialogue, and there's enough bits like that to sort of buoy this along to be pleasant enough.
Okay. Has it hit Hotel Transylvania good yet?
No, well, Hotel Transylvania is just manic. Yeah.
But it's consistent, is my point. The first three in particular, like, consistently. Was there a fourth?
I think a fourth one is coming.
Okay. But Hotel Transylvania 1 through 3 are, you know, they're not all as good as each other, but they're all consistently funny, and you can have a really good time with any of them. Is it like that level of good, regardless of whether or not it's his man?
No, because I think they're afraid to go full-bore monster with the Addams Family in these movies. They're trying to make it a little too friendly and hip. Gomez, like, his biggest crime is that he tells dad jokes. You know, he's not as like Oscar Isaac is really doing what he can with the material, but he's given some pretty limp jokes to tell. There's a subplot with Pugsley. Pugsley wants to start talking to girls for the first time, but doesn't know how. So of course he goes to Uncle Fester, who is slowly turning into a squid.
Yeah.
And also Wednesday happens to have a voodoo doll of Pugsley. So she's always like breaking its neck at inopportune moments.
Okay.
So some cute moments with Pugsley, like, floating through the air and slamming his face against stuff.
Whimsical. Does Lurch have a subplot?
No. And another subplot. They're on the run from the antagonist of the film, played by Wallace Shawn, who has evidence that Wednesday might not be their blood relative.
Ooh.
So there's a little...
They kidnapped her or something is the theory?
Well, she was switched at the hospital with another child when she was newly born.
Well, go get that money, Wallace Shawn.
Yeah.
You go get that money. You deserve that money.
This doesn't sit well with me, though, because in the beginning of the last Addams Family movie, Morticia was putting on some makeup, which was made of the ashes of her dead father.
Yeah.
I was kind of hoping that the Addams Family children would have been born in a sewer or something, or, you know,
well,
a mad scientist's lab.
It's weird to think of them going to a hospital.
Going to, like, a hospital. Yeah, like, they don't know what this town is, but
they went to a hospital 7 years ago for however long. That doesn't quite track,
about
does it?
13 years ago, whenever
that doesn't
Wednesday
track at
was
all,
born.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But yeah, she was switched in the hospital at birth, and now there's some questions to her biological lineage.
Here's how you do it. Because it's a kids' movie, you do a flashback, and it shows that she was, like, left, but instead of by stork, but, like, by, like, giant bat.
Or a giant raven or something.
Like, a giant raven, like, dropped her down the thing, and it's like, maybe the giant raven made a mistake. You know
Or she was switched at birth, but, you know, like, the switch was like a monster werewolf or something, like in a monster hospital.
There you go. Monster hospital sounds like a good thing. I just want to see that in general. So it sounds like a mixed bag.
It's a bit of a mixed bag. But
it's better than the last one.
The humor is really bland. What it gets correct is the spirit of the Addams Family and that they're weirdo death-obsessed outsiders, and I at least can appreciate that.
Alright, that sounds good. Mm. Well, there was another movie based on a TV series. And this is one, I didn't see The Many Saints of Newark, and I didn't because, well, here's the deal. Normally this wouldn't stop me, but I wasn't super gung-ho about it because I've never really seen The Sopranos.
Yeah.
I remember when The Sopranos came out.
In 2001, around there?
Yeah, around 1999, 2000. It was like the same year as Analyze This. Which has a very similar premise, or at least on the surface, of a mafioso going to seek therapy. Analyze This was obviously the
first aired in January of 99 and ran for 6 seasons.
I think Analyze This was later that year. But so I remember watching the pilot when it came out. And, you know, I'm from an Italian-American family. We're not, like, super Italian-American, but we have our culture. And I watched it and I was like, yeah, I've seen better. And so I just didn't keep watching it. And then it was, there was a Saturday Night Live sketch, which I've been trying to track down. It's a little, like, they're not all online, at least not officially. But they did a Saturday Night Live sketch, which was a parody of the many commercials that were running for The Sopranos. Because The Sopranos had these commercials that were full of critics' quotes. But the critics' quotes were not just, it's the best new show of the year. The critics' quotes were like, weirdly hyperbolically funny. And the one I'll always remember from the SNL bit, which sounds like something I'd actually read, which was, I am afraid to close my eyes when I watch The Sopranos, in case when I open them again, The Sopranos will not be there. It's like, people were really huge in The Sopranos. And again, maybe I was having a bad day and I need to see The Sopranos. I know a lot of people love The Sopranos. Maybe one day I'll give it another chance from the beginning again. And maybe I'll love it. Maybe I won't. Whatever. Long and short of it is, I haven't seen this really long show, and now there's a prequel movie to it, and I felt like, if I have time, I'll get to it, but if I don't, I'm not going to feel bad, because I really didn't have, like, I really wasn't equipped to, like, be what the audience this movie expected of me, which is someone who has seen The Sopranos, which is a lot of people. I suspect you have also not seen The Sopranos.
I've not seen one frame of The Sopranos.
Awesome. So this is going to be an interesting review.
It was on HBO. I didn't have cable, and I just haven't had the wherewithal to catch up with The Sopranos and on home video or any of the streaming services. I have a theory that the film needs to function on its own.
Sure.
You know, that's maybe a bit strict, but if I need 6 seasons worth of television to get any kind of understanding out of this film, then the film failed.
Well, yeah, that's a, but you're making the assumption that all movies must stand alone, and that's not necessarily,
that is a
somewhat old-fashioned approach to it, especially now that we have these massive mixed media types of stories.
Yeah, like the Avengers series has sort of deconstructed that, and that's because those are movies, but they function like a television series.
Yeah, and sometimes you'll get like a movie, and it's like, whether you need the show or not, it's just like another episode of the show. That's how I feel about the X-Files movies. They're just not very good episodes of the show. I mean, they're okay, but like, eh. Or what was another one? There was the Veronica Mars movie.
I was going to bring up the Veronica Mars
movie. That movie does not work on its own as a movie, and it's not a particularly good episode of the show either.
Well, the Veronica Mars movie was crowdfunded, and as such, it was nothing but references to the show. And,
yeah,
you know,
it was, quote, for the fans.
Yeah, it was specifically designed to get people who are really, really familiar with a lot of details of the show get their hearts racing. And I feel something as similar is going on with the many scenes of Newark, because I don't know what's going on in this movie. Because nothing's happening in this movie. Rather, there's a lot happening, but it's not really building to much of anything. After a while, you realize that it's sort of accruing, but there's no plot, as it were.
It doesn't stand alone in a meaningful way.
There's a few main characters that we're following, the main of which is a character named Dicky Moltisanti. Moltisanti, excuse me. Moltisanti, many saints of Newark. Yeah. That's the character's name, is Moltisanti, the Moltisantis of Newark. Dicky Moltisanti is played by Alessandro Nivola, and he's really good in everything, but in this as well.
I'm glad we're having a bit of a Nivola-sance.
Yeah.
He's really talented.
He got my attention way back in Face Off in 1997.
I think this might have been his first movie, and then, or at least it was around that time. He was in a movie called The Art of Self-Defense a few years ago with Jesse Eisenberg.
Too, yeah.
He should have been Oscar-nominated for that movie. That is a great, weird, mean comedy / drama performance that he's really, really great in. See that movie. It's dark, but it's good.
But his arc is that his father, played by Ray Liotta, has just come back to America with a new wife. She's played by a new actress named Michela De Rossi. She's really great in this movie as well. But he kind of mistreats her and talks down to her. She doesn't speak English at first. Dicky and Ray Liotta end up having it out, and he kills Ray Liotta.
Excuse me.
And he decides to go to his father's brother, who is also played by Ray Liotta. They're twin brothers.
Oh, okay.
Who's in prison for killing a made man. So he's in prison.
Also played by Ray Liotta.
The prison is played by Ray Liotta.
The prison's Ray Liotta head.
Yeah. Now, Ray Liotta has made a long part of his career as being the guy that women have to stoop to sleep with in order to get something done. He's played that kind of
a
role in a bunch of different movies.
Ever since he hit, like, middle age, That's been what he's like. His early stuff, like he was briefly leading man,
a little bit more. Yeah,
he was very handsome. Roles. Very handsome. Didn't he play like Frank Sinatra in that one HBO movie with Don Cheadle?
I didn't see it, but yeah, I think
it was.
It was just called The Rat Pack, if I recall.
I think it was. Yeah.
Ray Liotta's a good actor. He plays the two roles very well.
Yeah.
And he ends up taking his father's wife sort of under his wing and has an affair with her that lasts for years. And he ends up paying for apartments for her. And they actually have a very warm relationship. We hardly ever see his wife.
Mm.
We also follow Leslie Odom Jr. As a man who's trying to break into organized crime. Mm. And he has... he's sort of amassing, I guess, an army of mob followers. I'm not sure exactly what you call it. A mob of his own.
Mm.
And he intends to undercut the local mafia, who is the Soprano family. Who are just sort of small-time hoods. This movie starts in sort of the late 60s and runs through, the mid-70s.
Okay.
And observing a lot of this is the young Anthony Soprano. Who is played as an adolescent by Michael Gandolfini, who is...
James Gandolfini's son?
His son, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
James Gandolfini, the late James Gandolfini.
I saw the trailer for this, and I was like, God damn, they got a kid who looks a lot like James Gandolfini.
Yeah.
They got James Gandolfini's son. Yeah, looks good.
And he... we spend a lot of time with him, even though his story isn't anything. He's just a young troublemaker. He's, running gambling at school, and he's stealing ice cream trucks.
He does win that pod race. Against the Bulba.
Mm. He tries spinning the truck. That's a good trick.
That's a prequel joke.
Yeah, there's a lot of other characters besides Joey Coco Diaz is in this.
There you go.
I've met Joey Coco Diaz. He is a sweetheart.
Hmm.
I've seen him do stand-up. He's hilarious. He looks like he belongs in an Italian gangster movie or is like a guy on a subway. And in fact, he was a guy on a subway in Spider-Man 2.
The scene where
Spider-Man's unconscious and somebody's going after him. And Joey Coco Diaz stands up and says, "You gotta go through me." And you can't get through Joey Coco Diaz.
Well, Dr. Octopus actually got through him just fine. He uses his octopus arms and went, "Rah." It was the thought that counts.
Fine.
It was the thought that counts. It was the thought that counts. Thank you, Joey Coco Diaz, Spider-Man.
But we have all of these things, and it feels like we're setting up something, but there's no big change. There's no big story going on here. It's all leading towards some kind of big conflagration, and it's not until the film's over that you realize, wait a minute, that conflagration is six seasons of television.
Yeah.
This is sort of like a little mini spin-off of some characters that I assume have been alluded to in the past,
because
a lot of these characters die over the course of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Now we get to finally see, or I guess fans of the show finally get to see in action. When we're sort of setting them up and having them be their own complete characters, the actors are doing their darndest to bring a lot of personality to these scenes, but they're just sort of meandering along. Nothing's cohering as a film ought to. I'm waiting for the story to begin, and like I said, it accumulates. It's over 2 hours in length, and it just sort of accumulates and accumulates, and then it gets to the very end, and he says, And then I became Tony Soprano of The Sopranos.
Oh.
The premise of The Sopranos is, from what I understand, a gangster in therapy. That's one of the main
that's
setups.
That's and, the structure and it's, of and it's, it, yeah.
Is it Lorraine Bracco who plays the therapist in the show? Okay. I know a detail about it. there's a rather touching scene in this film where a young Tony Soprano's guidance counselor is having a talk with his mother, who's played by Vera Farmiga. And it's about how sort of sharing emotions is actually kind of a watershed moment for them, even though at that point he's an adolescent and doesn't really care about sharing his feelings, and in doing so isn't really going to help him. But the mom has a touching moment where she realizes, oh, she actually does have some good memories of her ne'er-do-well son.
Hmm.
It's a lot of yelling. A lot of unexpected murder. It's like somebody's just sort of talking and their head explodes.
In your mind, I'm curious about this, because there's more than there used to be, but they're still not the norm. Movie prequels have an interesting uphill battle because they lead to something that theoretically, at least, the audience already knows about.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a foregone conclusion. And you have two choices.
Mm.
You can try to make it so that it turns out the story you knew is not the story you knew.
Right.
And there's something, there's a whole bunch of surprises here.
You rewrite history a little bit.
Yeah, or there were unreliable narrators or whatever. Or there's an element of inevitability to it. You might have known exactly how it happened, but this is going to happen. And I think my favorite example of that is Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, you're leading up to a horrible murder and you're powerless to stop it. You know what's going to happen, and you just have to watch it inexorably march towards doom.
Yeah, I was going to bring up Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me because this is a great way of showing the events before the events of the show while also grandly expanding the mysteries. Also, Twin Peaks is such a mysterious show that if you are wandering into Fire Walk With Me and you have no connection to some of the symbolism or, like, why is the letter T under Teresa Banks' fingernail? That just sort of adds to the mystery of the film. It actually makes the whole... It adds to the texture of the movie, not knowing what the show was. I actually saw the movie before I saw any of the TV show. And I love the movie. I loved it the first time I saw it. There's a way to do a prequel where you expand on the ideas as a sequel would.
Yeah.
This may not be the best example, but I think it functions. Joker.
Okay.
It's the origin story of the Joker.
Yeah.
We get to know a little bit more about that character's world before we knew him as a Batman villain.
Yeah. And that's a weird one because it's not a prequel to a Joker movie that we know. It's not Jack Nicholson's Joker, Heath Ledger's Joker, but we're ultimately familiar with the concept.
Yeah, and you can kind of squint and connect it to whatever Joker story you want.
Yeah.
One that I think functions very well, and I know this is not a widely beloved film, but Ridley Scott's Prometheus.
Okay.
Which
I'm not a fan, but I know you like it.
Which I think gives us a few more hints as to what was going on in the movie Alien, but what it shows us is equally strange and mysterious. We get to see some things sort of explained what they are, but we don't know why they function, and they're connected to other things that we don't know what they are. And I think that's a good way of giving us a lead into something that's really kind of strange and mysterious while keeping it strange and mysterious.
I think a very bad example is actually Peter Jackson's Hobbit movies.
Peter Jackson's Hobbit movie? Well, Hobbit movies, the Star Trek movies, the Harry Potter prequels, these all have a sense of fatalism to them, that these things are destined to happen, and now we're just sort of waiting for what we already know to be set up.
That's true, but what I was specifically thinking about from the Hobbit movies, which makes them a little different than some of those other examples, is because The Lord of the Rings had such a specific tone and scope, it felt like the Hobbit movies were forced to match that rather than be their own thing. The Hobbit story is a smaller story. It just is by nature of its actual narrative and length. But because the previous Lord of the Rings movies were so gigantic, the Hobbit was turned into something more like that instead of just letting it be actually a very good prequel story.
It's a very good prequel.
What it is.
Could have made one single, even if Peter Jackson wanted to, you know, go whole hog and include every detail from the book, as he did with the
still be like
last
a 3-hour movie.
You can make a 3-hour live action Hobbit movie. You got everything. You get the dragon in it. Maybe that would have been fine. That's hard to say. While we're making a film based on The Sopranos, like, what has it been, like 16 or 17 years after it's been off the air?
Still popular.
Still really popular. Yeah. And thanks to the caprices of streaming deals, a lot of older shows do find their way back into the public eye again in ways that they hadn't in previous generations. So it became popular with a new generation, thanks to streaming. And so, James Gandolfini's son is getting into acting, perhaps.
This is what he wants to do. They were waiting
for him to be a certain age.
Is he good?
To say he's good, he's good. Fine. Yeah, I mean, I can't compare him to James Gandolfini because I haven't seen his performance.
You know, James Gandolfini is an actor, though.
As an actor,
he's a brilliant actor.
Yeah, I've seen him in other things.
Yeah. So, but the kid's good.
He's good. Alessandra Nivola is really the standout, and what's her name, Michela. De Rossi.
Okay.
Michela De Rossi is also really, really good in this.
All right. Well,
And Leslie Odom Jr. is always a delight. I love seeing Leslie Odom Jr. and also Vera Farmiga. But yeah, it's something where we're pointing to a lot of these fatalistic things that I'm not familiar with. And as such, the creators don't seem to have found any kind of urgent need to tell any kind of story. It's like, we're just going to give us a little bit of color background. It's a footnote than it is an actual feature film.
Hmm. That could be interesting, almost like a slice of life gangster movie.
But it doesn't have that feel to it. Yeah. It doesn't. It has all of these. It's so incidental that it can't have a slice of life feeling to it.
Okay. Well. Okay. Well, I'm sorry this wasn't your film, but tell me, was this your man?
Oh,
and if so,
goodness.
Was it Dan Stevens?
Dan Stevens is everybody's man.
Oh, I wish. Mm. I'm a huge, huge fan of Dan Stevens. I'm actually bummed I didn't get to see this one.
Now, this one actually came out last week, but I was interested enough that I wanted to check it out. And yeah,
and you wanted to cover it today.
So, So thank you for letting me extend the episode.
It's our show. What am I going to do? Talk about whatever you want, yes.
I'm Your Man, directed by Maria Schrader. It takes place in the near future, and it's about a professor. She's a scholar of, like, ancient cuneiform tablets and, like, Babylonic languages.
Okay.
She's played by Maren Eggert, is the actor's name. And she has volunteered or has become involved with testing out a new line of love robots.
Okay.
They've been able to make robots that look exactly like people, and they've sort of quizzed her and have tried to find what is designed to be her ideal man. And they come out with Dan Stevens. Not a bad start.
I buy it. And, admittedly, that's you could just default to that and everyone would be like, cool. Thank you.
Evidently they went to Dan Stevens, A, because he's really handsome, and B, he's fluent in German. He actually he could already speak the language.
Didn't know that.
And at first, he only says really cliched things like, hello, it's good to see you. Your eyes are like pools I could get lost in. And, you know, he's very robotic. And and she says, no, I don't want to do this. And they keep on insisting, no, take it home. He has his programming has to sort of adapt a little bit to you. And
yeah, he's an algorithm.
Yeah, bring him home and see what happens. And he tries doing very cliched romantic things. I've poured you a bubble bath after a hard day. Isn't that what you human women like? There's a very solid data quality to the Dan Stevens character in that he's very, he knows a lot of human behaviors and he's interested in human behavior, but he doesn't behave like a human.
Right.
He behaves like an android. And a lot of the fascination of this movie comes from his discovery of human romantic feelings. And of course, the actual messy lives of humanity. The main character, the character's name is Alma, has no interest for these kinds of superficial romantic things. She actually is, she lives alone and she's very devoted to study. She's a very intellectual person. She's a very bitter person. She has a kind of sardonic sense of humor. She doesn't want to have to deal with this robot and his sort of fawning compliments because she knows they're not genuine. She can't get her mind around the fact that this is an algorithm. And what I appreciate about this movie is it does kind of ride the line between, like, explaining how conscious the robot is. Is Dan Stevens actually developing a consciousness, or is he just fulfilling a program? And as the film goes on, a few crises arise at her work, and that sort of is really bad for her, and she overindulges in drink and wants to have sex with the Dan Stevens robot one evening, but he turns her down.
Huh.
Which, you know,
okay,
you know, it's like, consent is programmed in that, so he understands that, but at the same time, he is a thing.
Well, or is he?
Maybe he's just sort of a sophisticated vibrator at that point.
Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. Is that the question that they ask?
No, it doesn't go too deep into that. What it ends up going to is a little bit more of a thoughtful, melancholic place about the nature of lost love. And how that kind of loss and loneliness is actually kind of a vital part of a lot of us.
Okay.
And, Dan Stevens kind of starts to understand that by the, like, there's no big catharsis, but by the end, he kind of comes to a slightly more human place without sort of becoming fully human. There's not one of those insufferable tears in the rain speech like in
Blade Runner. Shut up. Any chance you can take a pot shot at Blade Runner?
Blade Runner stinks and I don't like it, and I'm gonna say so.
My heart.
Those memories are but tears in the rain. Those memories aren't real. They were programmed. Move on.
That's the point. Okay, anyway. All right.
He knows they're fake at that point, though.
But they're all No. The things he's seen were things he had seen in his short lifespan. They weren't fake memories. Those were, he was actually like employed as a soldier robot. And the things that he's talking about are things that he saw in war that no one else will ever know, because he was only designed to live for a few years. And his impermanence is far worse than any human being's. And that's tragic. Dingus. Okay.
I'd watch the movie again, but I don't want to.
Tell me about... let me ask you a question. Yeah. Because the movie, as you're describing it, there's a... there aren't a lot of great movies about people falling in love with, like, their sex robots or whatever. But the two that come to mind, and I'm curious if how they compare, if you even know. Have you seen Cherry 2000?
I've seen Cherry 2000.
Cherry 2000 takes place in a near future where there's been an apocalypse, and also... dating has turned into a legal thing, and so a lot of people just enjoy having their sex bots.
It was a reaction to the AIDS crisis, there was a lot of, all of a sudden, it seemed like in the dating world that there was a lot more litigation going on.
Yeah.
It's like, well,
people were less...
Just wear a condom and communicate. That's all that was really necessary, but it was played up to comedic effect in Cherry 2000, where people bring their lawyers on dates.
One of them was played by Lawrence Fishburne.
That's right. And if you wanted to be extra safe and you had the money, you could purchase a love bot who would just compliment you and have sex with you whenever you want.
And at the beginning of the movie, this one guy's love bot breaks, and the only replacement part is in, like, the Road Warrior wasteland.
It's like out in the Badlands.
So it's Mad Max. It's like Fury Road, except instead of, like, trying to find, like, a utopia where we can all live free, he's just trying to fix his sex bot so he can go back to his 9-to-5 desk job and be happy. Weird movie.
He has to be let in by Melanie Griffith, and she's a real human being, and is he going to get along with a real human woman?
It's actually a pretty good movie.
Robert Zadar has a cameo.
But the one I was actually thinking of the most is actually an underrated movie, and I haven't seen it in a while, but are you familiar with Making Mr. Right with John Malkovich?
I didn't see that.
It's a film by Susan Seidelman. Susan Seidelman, by the way, is one of the great auteurs of the 80s that people don't talk about enough. She also did Desperately Seeking Susan, and as far as I'm concerned, her true masterpiece, She-Devil, which is a great movie. But she did this movie called Making Mr. Right, which starred John Malkovich as a scientist who invents an android for, like, deep space travel. Someone who will, like, not have to worry about things like resources or loneliness, but can man ships and do anything a human being could do while they were out there. And he makes it look just like him, so he plays a dual role. And the PR person for the company ends up falling in love with the robot, and the robot ends up evolving and becoming more human than his creator.
Yeah.
And it's actually, like, it's goofy in a lot of ways, but it's actually really sad and thoughtful, because that's what Susan Seidelman does. But, like, I don't know, I feel like there's so much, like, interesting potential here.
And that's why I think I'm Your Man is so intriguing, is that it is sort of sad and thoughtful.
Okay.
I'm glad. You know, plays a little bit with its science fiction premise, but it doesn't delve into pure intellectuality.
Okay.
It does deal with sort of the plague of loneliness that goes along with humanity. And because this is a European film or even a German film, it doesn't come to very rosy conclusions. It's free to be a little bit sad.
Okay.
I feel like if this was an American film, if it were sad, it would have been like a heroic kind of tragedy.
Yeah.
Like I've discovered my humanity, and I'm going to sacrifice myself and not tell have my mind erased or whatever. Here I think they're just sort of letting them say out loud, there is a lot of loneliness and we are relying on platitudes and machinery to fill the void that should be filled by other human beings. Because to have a relationship with another human being is messy. It's not about just getting what you want. It's about meshing your relationship with another human being's life. And you know, they are complete, and they're meshing with you as well.
Like in Venom, Let There Be Carnage.
Yeah, Venom, Let There Be Carnage knows just as much about relationships than I'm Your Man.
There you go. All right, well, that sounds cool. Well, next up, it's October, and so we're starting to get an influx of horror movies. A lot of the streamers are starting to put out a whole lot of horror movies. There's like 4 or 5 that debuted this last weekend. Whitney saw one, I saw the other. I haven't reviewed a movie in a little bit, so I guess I'll do mine and we'll finish up with yours. Let's talk about No One Gets Out Alive.
Tell me about No One Gets Out Alive.
Well, No One Gets Out Alive, Whitney.
Oh, well. It's like John dies at the end.
A bit of a spoiler, isn't it?
Gave it away.
No, this is a movie starring Christina Rodio as a woman. She is an undocumented immigrant from Mexico. So she's living off the grid. She's working in a sweatshop. And she is trying to put together some semblance of a life after putting her life on hold to take care of her dying mother. Mm. She ends up getting an apartment at a really ramshackle old building full of personality. That is obviously haunted because look at it, for God's sake. It's one of those things that might as well just have a neon sign. Probably haunted. Be a good name for the movie. But she moves in because she needs it's cheap and they'll take cash and she can do what she needs to do. But she has certain needs. She needs to get a fake ID by Friday so she can get an actual decent job. But that puts her in a position to really leave herself vulnerable to con artists and people who are trying to exploit her. And the best parts of the movie are just her trying to survive in an America that doesn't want to make room for her. The worst parts of this horror movie are the horror stuff.
Oh, no.
Which is not a great place to start, because the actual horror stuff in the movie is, there's a mysterious noise coming from the basement. And the super of the building says, don't go down there. And I'm like, okay, so there's something down in the basement. Cool. Well,
I remember a description Roger Ebert once gave of a horror movie where it says, people sneak into dark attics and extend parts of their bodies into places where they will soon be forensic evidence.
Well, the thing I kept thinking about is, did you see the remake of The Woman in Black with Daniel Radcliffe?
I did. I saw the sequel, too. I don't remember a thing about those movies.
Okay.
They just passed right through my brain without hitting any brain cells.
The sequel's so damn forgettable. But the original, like, made-for-TV horror movie, The Woman in Black, is actually pretty scary. It's not my favorite, but I know why a lot of people love it. But the Daniel Radcliffe remake is basically Daniel Radcliffe moves into this obviously super-duper haunted house. And, like, the majority of the movie is him walking down dark hallways, opening a door and going, anything scary yet?
No.
Okay, I'll be back.
It's clearly inspired by the turn of the screw.
Yeah. But, and then he turns around and something is scary. And then he goes, walks around like, okay, what about now?
Scary? Good? No.
All right, I'll be back. One more time. Oh, no, it's scary. Okay, great. I'm as scared as I have ever been. I'm Daniel Radcliffe. And then he closes the door. Like, it's just really repetitive. And there's something that's, when you're watching this movie, it's just like kind of baseline haunting movie. Hmm. Where it's the skeleton on which most haunting movies are based. But it doesn't really do much with the actual haunting story. Everything you suspect is going on. Oh, everyone's having these like weird hallucinations about this weird box. Okay, well, there's something in that box, and that box is in the house, isn't there? And the movie's like, well, yeah. And I'm like, cool. We're not going to get that until really late, aren't we? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, okay, cool. What's happening until then? Well, she's going to stand around, and there'll be something behind her once in a while. Okay, so when the movie finally, like, kicks into the climax.
So frustrating. I can hear your frustration.
Like, it's not bad. It's just really mediocre for a lot of it. And ultimately, you know, most horror movies, especially haunting movies, are not about what they're about. They're not about, ghosts are real and it's scary. They're about something...
Dissolving of a family unit.
They're about something that's going on inside the character's head.
Yeah.
This character is haunted by something. And they would be haunted by that even if there weren't ghosts. Here, what the character's ostensibly haunted by the death of her mother, but what she's really... What's really plaguing her is the constant oppression of living in America, where there's this a lot of opportunity, but people are desperately trying to keep it from you. That does not connect to the storyline in the house. The storyline in the house is way more about, like, generational and institutional misogyny.
Okay.
And the rest of the story wasn't really about that, so those two things don't really connect. It climaxes with pretty neat monster. Like, I'll give you, like, there's a cool, like, scary thing at the end of the movie. But when the movie finally concludes as it concludes, like the way it ends, like the last thing, you realize that this doesn't connect thematically to anything either. And it feels like they're just, instead of this the idea that here's someone whose situation, the socio-political situation, their financial situation, their immigration situation, their living situation, is the source of their anxiety, and that anxiety is the source of the horror.
Mm.
It feels like it's just an excuse to keep her in the house because she can't leave because she doesn't have anyone else to go.
Jeez.
And that's something that's hard to do in a haunted house story. It's like, well, why do you stay in the house? Leave.
Yeah.
Like, there needs to be a valid reason. It's why Poltergeist works so well. We can't leave. Our daughter is missing somewhere in this house. There's a reason to stay.
In one of the very few funny jokes in A Haunted House, which is a spoof movie.
Oh, yeah.
The two good bits. One where the ghost is trying to distract them and they're determined not to look.
And the ghost keeps doing bigger and crazier things. Like they're just eating their cereal.
Like pass the sugar. And the other one is something ghostly happens and they say, "We're going. That's it. We're not going to stick around where there's a ghost in the house." And then they come back in tears and say, "But the equity. Like, we just paid for this house. We can't afford to go a new place now." Yeah. So they have to go back in for financial reasons.
Practical thing, isn't it? Are the two funny bits.
The rest of the movie sucks.
Yeah, but like, again, you've got to come up with a reason for them to stay, or like they're trapped in the house and it's like takes place over a short period of time, but this takes place over the course of like a week. So just fucking go. And the excuse for her to stay is there. But that's unfortunately all it reads like when it's actually like you're spending so much time and real estate in the movie on this, you're not really making the most out of it thematically or even character-wise or even scare-wise. Mm. And it just, I feel like this is the kind of movie where it's all made with good intention. Nothing is like really bad about it. I'm just explaining why it never kicks in.
Okay.
This feels like the kind of movie you watch if you're like trying to come up with ideas for a horror movie. So like
this is the baseline reading and now you can make alterations.
So like you watch this movie and you think to yourself, okay, what would be scarier here? What would be more interesting here? What location would be more exciting? What would it be more interesting? Okay, so that's the explanation of what's going on. Well, that's not very interesting. What would be more interesting? And then you could build on it.
Mm.
This feels like it really needed, I don't know, it's based on a book. I don't know how faithful it is. This feels like it needed some development because it's just pretty thin.
Yeah.
And that's very unfortunate. So if you're an easy mark for like ghost stories, this still might engage you and be kind of creepy because it's atmospheric.
Mm.
But if you've seen a lot of them, if you're a fan of ghost stories and haunted house stories in particular, this really isn't going to give you much, unfortunately. It's a real bummer, honestly. I'm not mad at it. It's just never kicks in. What about Welcome to the Blumhouse, Black as Night?
Black as Night. Welcome to the Blumhouse is actually a whole series of films. Last year they came out with four around this time of year. I got to see two of them.
I don't remember which one.
Let me look up the titles of the two I got to see. But they ended up making four, two 1 week, two the following week, and they're doing the same thing this year. Blumhouse... bless Blumhouse for what they do. They are able to make a good deal of horror films with a lot of ambitious filmmakers. They give them a lot of chances to see if they can make a good horror film under budget. That's sort of their biggest deal.
They give you a very low budget and knock yourself out. Mm. Yeah. Sometimes you get something really great out of it, sometimes you don't, but the financial commitment is so small, it's not a big deal usually.
I saw a movie called Black Box last year, it had a premise similar to that of that film, The Cell, where you could use a science fiction machine to enter into other people's brains.
Yeah.
And it's about manipulating memories. There's also a film called The Lie, a film called Evil Eye, a film called Nocturne. I saw Nocturne was pretty forgettable.
Yeah.
But this week they released two. One was called Bingo Hell. I did not see Bingo Hell. And I saw Black as Night, directed by Marit Lee Goh. And she is telling a vampire story. This is a vampire story set in modern-day New Orleans. The main character is played by a young woman named Aja Cooper, and she's about 14. And the opening is very Judy Blume. She's talking about she has a crush on a boy, and the opening line is, The summer I got my breasts was the summer I fought vampires.
Mm.
So she's very self-conscious about her body. She's passing through puberty and having a lot of anxiety in that regard. And she's also has a lot of anxiety about her color. They actually talk very openly about how people with black people with darker skin seem to have fewer opportunities than black people with lighter skin. And she's concerned about that. And this is actually something that weighs very heavily on her mind. Hence the title, Black as Night.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you know it, there's some homeless people around town who have been attacking people at night, and they're clearly vampires. Mm. She finds that one of them is, like, in a shack at her school. He's just been hiding out there. She is attacked one night, and she's bitten, and she immediately runs home and plasters up the windows and says, I'm definitely a vampire. Like, she doesn't consult with anybody. She doesn't just, like, oh, that was it.
Why risk
it? I know what's going on here. This is vampires. Her best friend... the clichéest of cliché of gay best friends. Unfortunately, is just nothing interesting is done with this character. Tells her, no, I don't think you're a vampire. She's like, yeah, I definitely am. We have to go to the local, like, vampire fiction goth girl conclave to get some more information. So they team up with this vampire writer. Uh-huh. And, of course, the boy she has a crush on, who's, like, this big... muscular young man, because they need some muscle as well.
I remember once I got, because I kept seeing in movies whenever someone like was like possessed by a demon or attacked by vampires, they always went to their local library and got like some ancient tome book or whatever.
I always liked the research montages.
Do you ever actually go to a library and see what their supernatural section is like? Because in my experience, it's pretty thin.
It depends on the library.
We went to, there's a library on... on Westwood, it's Overland. It's a library in Overland. I went there and I was just like, I'm just gonna see, like, what if this was the only library I had access to, and someone I knew was possessed by a demon. And I did all the research I could. I picked up all the books, and here's what I got: if someone you know is possessed by a demon, get an amulet. That's it. That was all they had. It was like, so useless.
Just like any amulet. Well, that's apparently easy. I just go to Marshall's and pick one up.
Exactly. It was so disappointing.
Yeah.
I digress.
But they proceed to go vampire hunting. And as it turns out, our young heroine's mother has been vampired. And she's had a strained relationship with her mother. Her mother was an addict and was recovering, kind of at risk, still on the cusp. And she died as a result of the vampire. So now the goal is to get revenge against the head vampire, who may or may not be this local celebrity who's living in this big mansion in New Orleans. Or is it Keith David, our celebrity guest?
Ooh.
I think it might be Keith David, our celebrity guest.
Is the celebrity, not guest, but within the narrative, are they played by someone cool?
He wasn't anybody I recognized.
Oh, okay. Because that would be how you hide it. You have, like, two celebrity guests, so you don't know which one it is.
Yeah, it's like in, you know, Law and Order, you have a celebrity guest. It's them. They're the killer.
Yeah, you...
That's why you got the celebrity guest.
You don't get
Martha Plimpton and have them not be the killer.
Yeah, you just see Martha Plimpton just shows up in the lineup, but it's not them.
Yeah.
And that's it. That would be a great misdirect, though.
Oh, no. It's Martha Plimpton. No, not her. Well, we're moving on.
No. Too obvious.
I don't know why I chose Martha Plimpton. She was on a guest on
the I love Martha Plimpton. So, Martha Plimpton's great.
She's going to be in a movie next week called Mass. Get to that one.
Okay.
This movie is as perfunctory as they get in terms of this kind of stuff. Last year, a really wonderful movie came out called Vampires vs. the Bronx about younger kids. They were like maybe 10 to 12. Who discovered that vampires were moving into their neighborhoods, and it was actually vampires who were responsible for gentrification.
Yeah.
Cute movie, really wonderful, nice light in spirit and tone.
Concept is a bit obvious, but it really works.
Yeah, it's a good sleepover movie, and the scenes where they're watching the movie Blade for research are really hilarious.
Yeah, it makes me chuckle just thinking about it. Yeah. That's a good film.
This doesn't have any of that kind of wit to it. Like, the idea of, like, we have to go to, like, the goth girls who are meeting in a church talking about vampires for, like, legit information is kind of amusing. But they don't give us any information that we don't have from generations of vampire movies.
Yeah.
There is one interesting bit, and it comes near the end, where they finally cornered the villain, and it turns out he's a black man who's been living in New Orleans for hundreds and hundreds of years. And he says, you know what we're going to do? We're just going to kill white people now. Because we've been slaves in the past. we've seen all of these slave uprisings. We've seen all of these protests. They even mentioned the Black Lives Matter protest of 2020. Mm-hmm. And they say, when has it stuck? We're still being oppressed. This sucks. And if you're a black vampire, yeah, generations of oppression now. I wish they had like played with that a little bit more.
Expanded on that idea. Yeah, that's like
this is a really interesting concept. You just sort of drop right at the end of this movie during the climax of the movie. It's like no, this do more. Yeah. You just said something really interesting.
It sounds like that they really wanted to do was like a coming of age thing, though. Is it worth as a coming of age story?
It doesn't really, because quite frankly, the characters are so boring. You know, we understand that our lead is. Aja Cooper, the Aja Cooper character, is really insecure in that adolescent sort of way, and she's insecure about her, about the way she looks, and about her body, and about her race. These are all the things that are brought up, but I feel like the film doesn't really explore them in any kind of deep or meaningful way, and doesn't let her be her own character. She is nothing more than just that collection of vague traits written down on a character sheet. And Aja Cooper is... she's doing what she can, but she's not really given a lot of character work to really sort of build that character up. So there's a lot of interesting ideas in here in terms of racial justice and using, you know, the supernatural to explore that. But the most interesting concepts are brought up and then let go just as quickly. And it becomes really kind of this rote, very brief vampire thriller. It is pretty disappointing.
Wow. Sounds like we both ran into some pretty tepid... Yeah. Straight to streaming horror films. Well, maybe it'll pick up next week. Next week.
Let's grade movies before we move to next week.
Is there anything big coming out next week?
Oh, there's a James Bond movie coming out next week.
I was trying to lead to some sort of joke and I couldn't think of one. It's after 1 a.m. Let's wrap this up.
Vampires cannot die and there's no time to die. There you go.
Great. Thank you. All right, let's review some movies on the critically acclaimed scale. Once again, for anyone who's new or needs a refresher, we review films on a scale of C- to C+. The lowest the movie can get is a C-. That's below average. Everything from we just don't recommend it to the worst movie ever. C is average. A little bit of good, a little bit of bad. Maybe better for some audiences than others. And then C+ is above average. We genuinely recommend the movie. We might even think it's legitimately great. On that scale, where does Welcome to the Blumhouse Black as Night fall?
It's a C-. Keith David is the good part of it, and I am loath to scare people away from a Keith David performance. But yeah, it's just not really worth your time. It is just... frustratingly uninteresting.
Yeah, that's how I felt about No One Gets Out Alive. That is also a C-. It's not a passionate C-. It's not a terrible movie. There's just really nothing all that interesting about it. If your taste in horror movies doesn't skew very complex, you might enjoy like a pretty straightforward baseline haunted house story. But if your standards are higher than that, you're not going to enjoy this. And I even think then you're not going to really love it. So that's
why not have high standards?
Oh, that's why we're here. What about I'm Your Man?
I'm Your Man is a really high C. I feel like there's a lot more profound things that could have gone on here. But more than anything, it's just a rather intimate tale of loneliness.
Okay.
That's all it ever aspires to be. And I think it does that well rather than sort of going way off into the heavens with high ideas.
Okay, The Many Saints of Newark.
That is a C-. Yeah, there's a lot of good performances, a lot of interesting things happening in the movie, but there's no movie here. It's just sort of a bunch of stuff that happens.
Although, again, we remind you with the caveat that review comes to someone who never watched the show.
Yeah, I never watched.
Maybe if you watch the show, you get something else out of it, but if some people haven't, that's the perspective Winnie's coming from. Next up, The Addams Family 2.
It's a C.
Okay.
Yeah, the last one I gave a C-. This is a definite improvement. Still a little bland, still a little too family-friendly. All of the pop music inserts were pretty insufferable, but at least they got the spirit of The Addams Family right, and that's always a nice place to be.
All right, Titan is a C+ from me. I have no idea what it is, but I like it. I think that's the best I can say. It's a very emotionally earnest film with a plot that is almost designed to keep you at arm's length. But I think the more you delve and the more you dig, the more you'll get out of it. And I've been enjoying having this movie sort of ruminating in my head for the last few days. I really did think it's something very interesting.
There's definitely a lot to think about here about rage and body horror and gender identity and just a lot of interesting things besides.
Mm-hmm. Incredibly fluid nature of love as a concept.
There's a lot to discuss, and it's really fascinating, and it's really marvelously repellent while drawing you in with all these intriguing ideas. Definitely a C+.
Certainly there's nothing else like it in theaters right now. Mm-hmm. And lastly, Venom, Let There Be Carnage, C+.
C+. It's really, really fun.
I really dug it.
Fun, silly, romantic slime monster movie.
It's a character-driven superhero story. It's very efficient. It raises some interesting themes. It explores them pretty well.
I will say this. Leave before the post-credit stinger.
I don't care about the post-credit stinger. Because
the post-credit stinger sinks a lot of it.
I could go on. I don't want to talk about it in detail because a lot of people haven't seen it yet. But for me, the post-credit stinger is the absolute least interesting thing, least interesting part of that movie. It actually makes me really, really worried about the follow-up because I feel like they've already started missing the point in an effort to go in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And that really bugs me. And I also am also annoyed when we see a whole dang movie and the only thing people want to talk about is the teaser for the next one.
That's the way marketing has sort of trained a lot of audiences.
But can we enjoy the fact that we just had this cool movie?
We just had this cool
first.
We had a cool movie. There's an ad for the next movie at the end. Don't talk about the ad. Talk about what we got, which was this, like I said, a slime monster romance of the highest order.
This is the first that I can recall polyqueer superhero movie, and I loved it, and I'm glad that's there. We need more people making big swings like this. Go for it. Go nuts. Make it weird. And not that that's weird, but the movie itself. There's a brain-eating space slimes. It's kind of a weird thing, really. And yet, tender and romantic and progressive and full of fun performances. What a great film. I loved it. Anyway, that's it for this week. Next week, we'll be back with some sort of Bond movie, I guess. We'll also...
25th Bond movie?
I think officially it's like the 25th. But there's also the non-canonical ones. Never Say Never Again.
25th canonical James Bond movie.
The 1960s Casino Royale. The TV movie Casino Royale. Both of which are good, by the way.
Also be that movie Mass I mentioned earlier with Martha Plimpton is coming out next week.
Lamb is coming out next week.
And other things besides.
I'm sure there'll be plenty. If there's more Blumhouse stuff, we might get to that too. But anyway, that's what's coming up next week on Critically Acclaimed. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you so much for joining us for our movie reviews. We're very grateful to have you here. If you haven't already, please subscribe. If you want to get even more shows from us in addition to the free feed at the Critically Acclaimed Network, we have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a lot of exclusive shows there for our patrons. Shows about Batman, shows about every single episode of Star Trek in order. We're doing Next Generation right now. Shows about every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. We need to get on that. We have an episode due in about a week. We do commentary tracks. We do hangouts every single month. You get to vote for future episodes of our shows. There's a lot of stuff over there. Thank you to every single one of our patrons for helping this show and all our other shows stay afloat. Without you, they could not. So it means a lot to us that you're helping out. You can also follow us on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
We also have an email address. If you want to email us, we might read your email in an upcoming episode of our show, We've Got Mail. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. Box. Whitney, tell us about the P.O. Box.
Yeah, you can write us a physical letter. Send us a letter in the mail. We like that. It's been slowed down because, screw that dude, but he's slowing it down for us. But you can still get it to us, and we'll still read it. our P.O. you can write to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
I want to give a very special thank you to one of our patrons who sent me a t-shirt from the Salem Horror Fest. Very, very cool. I've been wearing it very proudly. Thank you so much for that. I guess that's it. So thank you everybody once again. You are awesome. We love you to pieces. Have a great week. Stay safe, stay sane, and never forget, everyone's a critic.
I wanna go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?